There are 7 million students in our colleges and universities. This sheer mass alone should give anyone pause who is tempted to generalize about the college age. And we all know parents who will clearly, calmly say to us that they don't understand their own family undergraduate, but who quite willingly and definitely will give forth a number of categorical statements about the manners and the morals of the undergraduates. Mr. Max Lerner, writing in Plain Dealer yesterday morning, described today's college student as a political activist, a radical. He said, and I quote, that the students are majoring in a non-course called confrontation with a minor in sanctuary and another minor in laying siege to presidents and college deans. As I read that article, I recall just a few weeks ago, Dr. Gallup had released some statistics garnered by a nationwide survey that showed that during the last year, only one student in five had engaged in any form of political activity, including the quite pedestrian and conventional forms of canvassing areas for presidential candidates or securing voter registration. Dr. Gallup further suggested that the radical right, the politics of confrontation, actually won the allegiance of less than 1%, less than one student in 100 on today's campus. Dr. Lerner teaches American civilization at Brandeis University. And there are some colleges, Brandeis in Chicago, Wisconsin, Berkeley, others, which have a tradition of political activism. Their faculty has been drawn by the traditions of their place. Their student body is drawn to the activity of that campus. And they tend to draw on a particular socioeconomic class, students with a particular range of talent and of interest. Each campus, in other words, has its own distinct personality. And the personality of the Brandeis campus is that it is upwardly mobile, urban, drawn from families which have some pretensions to culture with a capital C, and that it is predominantly Jewish. And like it or not, study after study of the radical student movements have indicated, Seymour Lipset observed just recently, that a predominant number of the student radicals come from Jewish backgrounds and Jewish homes. Now, I could not duplicate Dr. Lerner's observations from my own experience at Case Western Reserve. There is a verbal, visible, and vocal student radical movement on the campus here in University Circle. It is predominantly Jewish, but it does not represent the bulk of the Jewish students. Its great frustration is that it cannot reach out and activate, or as it would put it, and radicalize many of the other groups on the campus. And then, indeed, its strategy tends to be not directed towards the university and causes generally so much as towards the psyche and the soul of others in the student body. It recognizes, it realizes its smallness in size and its relative powerlessness if it cannot draw others in to its cause. Most of the students seem to be quite conventional, degree-oriented. Yes, they complain about some of the courses and their irrelevance, but they are on some road towards some goal, and only the war and the draft seem to be unifying and overriding issues. And the issue of the draft is a guilt-ridden issue for most of today's students, because they recognize that they have been privileged as a class. They have been, up until now, excused from military service until their education was completed. And so their opposition is not only a principled opposition to the war, which many of us share, but as they would put it, a hang-up. They have had a special privilege till now, and now has come the moment of truth, where they must either live up to their bold pronouncements that they will not go and that they will not serve, or compromise, as most adults have had to compromise in many areas, with the overriding and overarching rules of social living. There are differences then between universities, and there are differences within a university. Studies have shown that there are very few activists, dissenters, in the faculties of business or of medicine, law, the physical sciences and economics, and some of the other profession-oriented or vocation-oriented curriculum. The politicians, the dissenters, the radicals, the students who are most involved and convulsed and turbulent, tend to be drawn largely from the social sciences, especially from sociology and psychology, and from the liberal arts. And this fact has caused some teachers and some students to suggest that the root frustration they've already, as you can see, have made a value judgment as to the protests themselves. But they claim that the root frustration, which leads to the thrust of political action, comes from the frustrations of those who are studying in these particular disciplines. The sciences, engineering, the professional training on the college campus tends to be broad, well-refined, and cumulative. People know what they must know generally and specifically for the life work which they have chosen. On the other hand, the liberal arts tend to be diffuse, scattered, non-cumulative. Many of the students have no idea why they are studying what they are studying. And they also have the feeling that they are being shortchanged. College is expensive today, but the burden of interest on the administration and especially of the faculty tends to be on specialties, on professional training, on their own individual interests. And they are loath to spend time teaching undergraduates. They will spend their teaching time in their laboratories doing research or teaching in the graduate faculties. And so the undergraduate student often is taught only by graduate assistants, by those who are doing what they are doing because it's being forced on them, and they have a sense born out of sad experience that the professor's mind is elsewhere and that he is really not involving himself with them and their concerns and their interests. He is teaching Milton or Chaucer with an eye to those who will teach Milton and Chaucer to another generation, rather than to those who are simply trying to understand literature, aesthetics, the pleasures of reading, and to develop some critical skills in reading. One sees this especially in the history of the general survey courses which were developed 20, 30 years ago on many campuses. Courses in the humanities, courses in Western civilization, which were originally designed to give the young student a broad overall view, a scheme, a framework into which he could fit the various specialties and the various courses he then took. Everything would presumably have a shape and have a form. Now, most of these courses in many universities have been abandoned. And they have been abandoned not because they were educationally unsound, they were sound, but because the faculty did not want to spend the time required of TNT in large lecture courses and small seminars with the lowly undergraduate. It was far easier to say that the undergraduates were complaining about regimentation, they wanted greater freedom, so let's open up the entire curriculum, let's let them impulse buy, take whatever courses they want, and in the name of freedom, the faculties largely unburdened themselves of an unwanted responsibility. And so many of the young people cross the way and elsewhere. Take a course here, and a course there, and a course here, and little of it is related for them in a meaningful fashion. All of it tends to be specialized. The professor has in mind the model student who is going further in that particular discipline. Little of it is relevant. Little of it is designed for the humanist, for the person who wants to be a generalist. Simply the person who has taken liberal arts in order to be more sensitive and a better judge and a better citizen. Perhaps what I've been saying can be illustrated by the experience of Berkeley. You remember 4 or 5 years ago, one of the first great college dissents broke out on the Berkeley campus. It was called the Free Speech Movement. It had many goals and many complex ends in it. But because of the personality of the Chancellor of Higher Education in California, Mr. Kerr, one of the things which emerged from this protest was the determination that the student should no longer be an IBM punch card, a nameless face, a cipher, forced to come to large lecture courses who never really met some of the best minds, the senior people on the faculty. And the only two results of all the committees of faculty which met in Berkeley subsequent to these free speech movement demonstrations to improve the curriculum, the only two decisions were these. One, to eliminate all the general survey requirements so that the young person was presumably free to have the education he wanted. And secondly, a petition to the administration to reduce the teaching load of faculty members from 6 hours per semester, 2 semesters in 3, to something less. In your next incarnation, dear friends, your goal should not be to return as a Jewish housewife, but to return as a Jewish professor. Now, some have said that whatever truth there may be in this analysis, it doesn't go deep enough. But the problem with the liberal arts, the frustration that many of our young people inevitably feel towards their college education, is that essentially this kind of training is useless in our society today in a dead end. Those who are in the professions, those who are studying a particular discipline, who are gaining the piece of paper which will allow them to proceed in a particular field of their choice, they recognize the importance, the reasons for being in college. But as one youngster at Reserve Riley put it to me, with my Bachelor of Arts in English and 10 cents, I am qualified to buy the New York Times and to read it with some understanding. Our society has, over the last 100 years, so structured itself that we have changed the university from a place in which a person became an educated citizen to a place in which he learnt the apprentice crafts required in a trade. And so it is that whether it's the clergy or government or education or social service or business even, we expect the colleges to do the on-the-job training, to give the specialized background so that we don't have to invest that much of our budget in training people. And the young person who presents himself to the personnel officer was simply a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy with the credentials of being an almost educated human being. That young person has nothing going for him, because that corporation or that social agency or that teaching staff will have to invest time and money in his specific training. Far easier to require it of the colleges. And we had better ask ourselves, this being the case, whether we are wise in directing so many of our young people into the liberal arts. Why do we send them? Because we recognize instinctively the value of having a general overall knowledge, some Catholic information about the world in which he will be a citizen. But we have structured the society against this kind of training. We are only building up frustrations and anger in a young person by suggesting that he follow this course. We have two alternatives. Either to change the hiring patterns in the society so that a medical school or a school administration or a social agency or the government will welcome the generalist and give him the training after he has been hired that he requires for a specific job. Or else we had better abandon the aim of education as one which informs a young person in a balanced way about his world and admit that all our schools are trade schools and that the only reason for being in college is to prepare oneself in a craft or a skill. But very frankly, the young person who graduates from Cuyahoga Community College with a degree in computer technology or in medical technology is far better off in the job market than a young person who graduates from Harvard or Columbia or Chicago with a Bachelor of Arts degree in sociology or in philosophy or in English. What I'm saying is that it is time that we looked at the student body and saw its variety, recognized many problems which many of these young people are facing, and faced up to the fact that we are dealing not with a group called the undergraduate, capital T, capital U, but there we are dealing with 7 million young people, some of them wise and some of them foolish, some of them full of talent, some of them quite pedestrian, some of them high-minded and some of them quite vulgar, some of them who have already been fortunate enough to know where they are going and who are happily at work getting there, some of them who are burdened by our preconceptions about what a college education should be, and who are very much frustrated by what they are receiving, and who are angry because their various attempts to change the university, to make it more relevant, have been met largely by indifference, or by faculties and administrations which have other interests, because it is the graduate faculty which receives the largest amount of government subsidy. It is the graduate faculty which receives the research money. It is the graduate faculty which will attract the best professors. It is the graduate faculty which will bring the Nobel Prize winners to the campus. It is the privilege of teaching very few hours, which the best professors ask for in their contracts. It is time that we freed ourselves of some of the generalizations, pro and con, which we hold almost sometimes simultaneously about our young people. On the one hand, we say of them, they're spoiled, they're an ungrateful lot, they're ill-mannered, they're going to pot, both figuratively and literally. And on the other hand, we say of them, they're the most honest and genuine and idealistic group in our society. They're the only group which isn't compromised. They're our hope and the key to American salvation. But what we fail to do is to recognize one simple truth. They are people, quite like us, all the frustrations and all the limitations and all the privations and all the opportunities which an ordinary human being has, that some of their problems are institutional, of our doing. Some of the problems are quite personal, their own hang-ups. Some of the problems are beyond solution. Some of them offer great hope for the future, and some of them must give us great pause about the future. Now, much more, of course, can be said on this subject, but what I'd like to do is to spend a few moments talking about that specific element of this problem which is unique to us, a particular fact which we had better analyze and understand, that a large and even predominant number of the student left wing is Jewish. Why is this? What does it mean? The fact itself, of course, is neither prejudicial nor a pejorative. That many of our young people, that a significant number of our young people are dissatisfied with the inconsistencies in our society, that they are determined to enlarge the justice which is about to bring the outs in, to bring the black within the mainstream of our society and the others who have been kept without, that they understand that there are still levels of poverty, classlessness, and of caste in our system, that these have not been eradicated. They are determined to establish justice and righteousness, civil rights. They are determined to find other ways to conduct foreign policy, save brinkmanship and an arms race. All this should give us pleasure. Fortunately, a large number, perhaps the majority of our sons and our daughters who are politically active, are active usefully and meaningfully, and if they move faster than we do, the criticism is on us and not on them. And if they speak with an impatience of our tendency to rationalize and to justify and to compromise and to refer to committee, if they want action, that too is commendable. Because we live in a chaotic and revolutionary age, and unless we pick up the pace of reform, we'll find that we cannot move ahead fast enough to avoid the kind of cataclysmic change which is destructive, violent. But having said this, there are other things that must be said. What has, for instance, the burning of a professor's research to do with the search for justice? What has the breaking into a dean's private files and correspondence to do with social reform? What has vulgarity, coarseness, the curse, gutter language to do with social change? Now, it's one thing to be impatient. It's another thing to be a boor. It's one thing to insist that we move forward faster. And it's another thing to verbalize the utmost contempt for all those in the society who do not agree with you. We have a tendency, some of us, to rationalize some of the actions of the extremist groups without looking at it carefully and objectively, simply because they're young and they're our own, and many of their causes seem to be approximately our own causes. And we don't look at what they're saying carefully. And we don't realize that some of these young people are not talking about social reform, but they're talking about revolution. About destroying all the due process and all the law and all the order, which is our only security. And some of them are raising the red flag of nations under whom we have suffered. We know what experience under such a flag means, and means to many of our people at this very hour. And those who raise that flag, who justify any means to ends we may share, who justify the manipulation of people and violence, such young people are not speaking our language, and they are not sharing our vision. And it's time that some of us stood up and said, yes, I believe in progress, and yes, I believe in immediacy, and yes, I believe that we must have many changes in the American system, but not your way. We know that a dictatorship of the left can be as vicious, censorious, as contemptuous of human dignity as any dictatorship of the right. And it's time that we all recognized also that there's a certain pathology involved in some of this activity. Some of the studies of the alienated, of those who have proclaimed themselves michutz lamachaneh, to have dropped out of society, show that almost 50% of these young people have a history of serious psychological trouble before the age of 15. And some of the cursing, some of the ugliness, some of the violence of their protests is nothing more than a collective childish temper tantrum. Nothing more than a venting of their own private demon. It has nothing to do with social causes. This is simply the mask of respectability which they give to the churning which is within. I'm not saying that most or even a significant majority, a minority of the radicals are involved in this pathology. I'm not saying that the vast majority of those who are demonstrating for causes and ideologies which are alien to everything that our tradition stands for. But I am saying that some are. And I am saying that some are acting in ways which flaunt and show contempt for every sanctity that this tradition has ever affirmed. Let me read you very briefly a report by Diana Trilling of some of the activity which took place at Columbia last year. There's language here which I will not repeat, but I think you'll get a feeling about some of this activity which will, I hope, destroy our instinctive feeling to justify and sanctify every form of youthful protest. At Columbia, it was Mark Rudd who launched the act of university insurrection with his letter to President Grayson Kirk. Addressed, Dear Grayson, it announced, as noted earlier, the intention of the Students for a Democratic Society to destroy President Kirk's world, corporation, university. The letter concludes with words from Leroy Jones, which I will not read. Such was the opening volley in a barrage of violent and abusive language and behavior which was sustained throughout the demonstrations. It was not only President Kirk who was addressed in such language, but Vice President Truman, Acting Dean Coleman, the police, any disapproved member of the faculty, etc. Rudd's response to the mediating efforts of the faculty was to call them to their faces. You have a line of vulgarity. In a Mediterranean importation, the revolutionary students spat at people they disliked, including senior faculty members. An old couple crossing the campus was shouted out at, "Go home and die, you old people, go home and die." A law professor, my neighbor, walking with his wife near the campus gates, was gratuitously punched in the stomach by a passing student wearing the red armband of his militancy. President Kirk's occupied offices were ransacked, his personal correspondence photostated for campus broadcast. His wastebasket was urinated in. The windows of his office were urinated out of. At a tense moment on the steps of Low Library, a Barnard girl demonstrator jumped up and down in front of the faculty line, shouting, "Vulgarity, vulgarity, vulgarity, vulgarity." In the police bus, another girl demonstrator bit a policeman in the stomach. The professor's papers were taken from his office files. They represented 10 years of research and burnt. He was an opponent of the revolution. During the occupation of Mathematics Hall, it was debated whether or not its library should be destroyed, although this plan was decided against. Quantities of notes and other personal papers were taken from various of the faculty offices in the building and scattered around the stairwell, because later, in preparation for the expected bust, liquid soap was spread on the stairs to deter the police, hoses had to be used, and the papers became an irretrievable mash. The day after the strike began, a member of the faculty who had helped persuade the president of the need for student participation in matters of campus discipline learned that the students were erroneously being led to believe that the membership of their new tripartite disciplinary committee was self-perpetuating. When he then went to a strike meeting of radical students and faculty to explain how in the future the disciplinary board would be elected, his request for the platform was refused. He was told that the chairman, a faculty colleague, could, quote, not take responsibility for the physical safety of anyone who came with such a message, unquote. The most gravely injured person in the two police actions at Columbia was not a student, but a policeman. He was permanently paralyzed when a student jumped down on him from above. On a terrace overlooking the campus, some students managed to lift a potted tree, which they crashed down over the side of the terrace. This was in the bust of May 22nd. It was only by good luck that no one was killed. A press which could not have been more diligent in covering the happenings at Columbia, or less capable of getting to the heart of the situation, reported little of this to the public. Certainly it reported none of the obscenities. The propriety of decent American middle-class life forbid it. But one has to ask, what decent American middle class our public media can have in mind when they exercise this censorship? Where do they locate this propriety they are so intent on protecting? The phenomenon being reported on was not of the gutter. This violence and nastiness took place at an Ivy League university. The speech and acts that our newspapers and televisions hid from the public were the speech and acts of young people who supposedly represent the American educated classes in their most ardent desire to rid us of the indecencies of our present society. And one discovered that a decent proportion of the decent American middle class mothers and fathers of these young people, as well as others, energetic spokesmen for progress, supported them. Mr. Rudd, father of Mark, strode around the campus boasting about his paternity. Mrs. Rudd, the mother of Mark, gave the proudest and tenderest of interviews to the Times about how her son, the rebel, plants tulips in their suburban garden. Some 200 or so mothers and fathers of students at Columbia banded into a committee of concerned Columbia parents to back their children and further harry the administration. And Mrs. Trilling's article may be prejudiced. I've read many, I confess, of the reports on the Columbia activity. Each one seems to describe to me a totally different world. But the milieu, the mood, the ugliness, the vulgarity, the coarseness, the violence, all this is true of all too many of these so-called policies of dissent, politics of confrontation. And if a sizable number or a disproportionate number of our Jewish young people are involved in precisely this kind of activity, we better ask why. Now, some of the reason may be that none of us have faced up to the fact that a large or sizable number of the Jews who came to the United States came carrying in their emotional luggage the vocabulary and the faith of radical dissent. Many of those who left Eastern Europe were already members of the Bund, of the Jewish Socialist and Jewish Communist parties. These were the restless, those who were most prepared to leave, those who had no roots in the traditional Jewish community, who were at war with it. And if they espoused in Europe an ideology which justifies any means to the end, they would justify it here. And one of the truths which has come out of all the studies of the student bodies is that the students tend to take over and to complete the politics of their parents and of their grandparents, only more so. And so many of these young students did not receive a synagogue education, this training, but were raised in radical homes and are continuing this radicalism on the campus. Some, but not all. Some come from congregations such as this, from homes such as yours, mine. And I think we must ask ourselves, what is there in this milieu which is conducive to this kind of eruption? Well, in some homes, I suppose there's tremendous guilt. The homes are fathered and mothered by the children of those who were immigrants, who worked their fingers to the bones to give opportunity to their children. Opportunity was then spelled education. The children used that education to move up quickly in the mobile American society and succeeded, and are now filled with guilt that they did not understand their parents and love them sufficiently and appreciate the sacrifices which were being made for them. And so all this love is now reversed and given to their children. But now it spells not the leaving of a cold water flat through the City College of New York, but now it's spelt things and presents and cars and mother being the servant of the child and father slaving for the child, not for the necessities, but for the luxuries. And many of our children, let's be honest about it, are growing up in a world which exists solely to serve them. Many of them are growing up to believe that everybody out there wants only their good, will do anything they can for them. Father will jump through a hoop. He'll give up his vacations. He'll give up his savings to buy them a car. Mother will be their chauffeur. No one questions what they want. It's enough that they want it. They get it. And then they get to the university. They get out into the great big world out there, and no one cares. The world's cold. It's not a nice Jewish home. And they're frustrated. They don't know how to react. And they react by jumping up and down in anger like a child. They react by taking it out at the world, at everything in the world. Nobody loves me anymore. The university doesn't love me. The police don't love me. My parents don't love me. The government doesn't love me. And this translates to violence. To an inconsiderate, unthought through kind of attack on the social system. And some of it also, I'm afraid, comes from a tendency in some of our homes to be glib, to be verbal, to state the negative and never the positive, to tear down the public official, to tear down the politician, to denigrate the political party, and rarely to talk about the ordinary decencies, the Hamish virtues, the basic necessities and decencies of the society. And a child grows up around a dinner table where all the traditional liberal positions are stated, thank God, but he hears them stated in a negative way. He hears gossip, he hears slander, he hears bitterness, he hears vindictiveness, he hears all the vocabulary of an alienated people. And he takes it literally. He takes it as emes, as the whole truth. And so he looks on his society and sees none of its virtues, but only the vices that he's been trained to see. How many of us talk with our children about that level of freedom and justice we enjoy in this country, a level which Jews enjoy here, which we have enjoyed no place else on this earth ever, except in our own nation. Rather, we attack the president. We're filled with frustration because this bill or that bill didn't pass in this Senate, in this Congress. Fine. I'm filled with the same frustrations, as you know. But let's paint the whole picture. Let's tell them why police exist positively, and not simply about some of the obscenities which policemen occasionally will shout, or the violence occasionally they'll use in the ghettos of the city. Let's talk about the good of our government and the meaning of justice under law, as well as some of its shortcomings. Let's talk about reform, not simply anarchy, destruction. I think we do it unconsciously, but we do it nonetheless. What I'm saying is this: let's not simply now, as we should never have done, bless dissent. Let's bless community and consent as well. And let's get over agreeing with all of the criticisms of the young. Perhaps they're right. But let's engage in dialogue with them and give them some of our own criticisms of them. You know, they say, I don't trust anybody over 30. I'm almost prepared to say, I don't trust anybody under 20. Until they prove to me that they're talking my language, that they mean what they say, that they're talking about a more humane and sensitive society and not simply anarchy, that they're willing to engage in the long pull for social reconstruction, and that I won't find 5 years from now, after all this stewing and all this turmoil, that they join the ranks of the fat, self-satisfied, disinterested, and disengaged. Judaism, my friends, teaches community. It exists to glorify the family. Through the ages, we've always taught our people how to live together in close quarters, rubbing elbows, without pushing elbows in somebody else's ribs. We have never justified an individualism which is selfishness, which has contempt for the needs of others, which seeks to manipulate others for private gain. Our appeal is to the soul of man, not to the greed of man. We taught our children respect and manners, as well as the passion for righteousness. And it's time, perhaps long past time, that we taught our children some of these old communal family virtues again. And it's time, perhaps long past time, that we said to impudence, that's boorishness, I won't tolerate it. That we said to the arrogant, as long as you're a member of our family, we speak as equals with respect for one another. Now I'm afraid that some will leave and that they will say that I have damned the young, that I've attacked activism, that I have preached for much firmer authority, a much more conservative point of view. I have not. I prize the true activists, those who go down into the bleak ghettos and tutor, those who volunteer for the Peace Corps and for VISTA, those who help to create political action within the displaced and the dispossessed communities in our nation, those who are truly committed to all social values, these I bless. And if the strategies they decide upon are not the strategies I might decide upon, I still approve of them. But I do not consecrate the home in which the child rules the roost and grows up with his swelled head, and is taught to think of himself as the savior of mankind. I do not approve the parent who accepts every indignity, every surliness without comment, who accepts every criticism of his generation or of his actions without subjecting the young person's actions to the same kind of rigid scrutiny. And most of all, I do not approve any and every act of dissent. For some are self-serving, and some serve foreign gods whom I do not bow down to, and some glorify violence and not the way of peace, and some use words not as vehicles of truth and information, but simply to mislead. And some degrade the human personality, and I prize human dignity. And some would destroy the last vestiges of the family, which I believe to be the fundamental building block of civilization. And it's high time, I believe, that we talked with our young people about the values that are truly ours, and that most of us get over the sense that we are somehow burdened by the guilt of all of the sins of inherited history, all the inabilities of men to create the truly messianic age. We are guilty only of our own shortcomings, and no man and no undergraduate but has his own, what is their phrase, his own bag of shortcomings. They're not the saints and we're not the outcasts. They alone don't have the vision. The very privilege of dissent is guaranteed to them because the older generation created the freedoms within which they can dissent. And those who raise the red flag or the black flag would quickly be sent elsewhere if they attempted what they attempt here under its authority. We lit today the lights of Hanukkah. The Maccabees fought for faith. They fought for freedom. God willing, all of us will fight for faith and for freedom. Freedom is not anarchy. Freedom is not contempt for human dignity. Freedom is not contempt for community. Freedom is not simply the destruction of all that surrounds you. After the temple had been cleansed, the Hasmoneans, the leading figures in the rebellion, went on to fight for kingdom and the crown. And most of our fathers deserted them. They were willing to fight for religious freedom, but not for dominion. They were prepared to fight for values, but not simply to hold a scepter in their hands. There is a difference in causes. There are judgments to be made. And it's high time that we began to make them. Amen.